what sort of keys or clues have you found to be helpful that, say, might be helpful to somebody who reads international news on a regular basis or who may even be doing some of their own research through various alternative networks as much as they can?
The kind of unpleasant initial answer to that question is that unfortunately, if you just reading the news, you won't sort of be able to figure anything out. I mean, you get a lot of the important information. A lot of the relevant information is in the daily news. But if that's what you're, if that's all you're reading, it's sort of mainstream news. It's very difficult to kind of pick it out and understand, you know, and be able to make those kinds of distinctions. So inevitably, you end up having to do some more research. So if you're looking at, you know, a given country, let's say, as an example, you're looking at Nicaragua, you might read in the news that there's a new movement. It's called the Movement for Nicaragua, and they're pressing all of the political parties to organize primaries. So, you know, that sounds great. I mean, this is not an American NGO that sort of, you know, has this kind of imperialistic attitude, you know, telling people in Nicaragua how democracy works. It's an NGO. It's a Nicaraguan NGO. It's led by Nicaraguans. And they're promoting primaries, which is obviously, I mean, it's a crucial element to any kind of democratization of existing sort of limited electoral democracies. At least if you start having some kind of popular decision-making power within parties, you can have, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But, you know, once you dig a little bit deeper, you find out that there's these two NGOs in Nicaragua that are working on this project of organizing primaries. One of them is the Movimiento por Nicaragua, the Movement for Nicaragua, and the other one is an NGO called Hagamos Democracia, which means Let's Make Democracy. And as soon as you do a limited amount of research, i.e. you go to the International Republican Institute website and you look under Nicaragua at the sort of statement there, you realize that Hagamos Democracia was actually, it was an NGO set up by the IRI in Nicaragua in 1995. And the whole reason that they would do something like that is to, you know, it's going to obviously tip people off immediately if you have the IRI walking around saying we have to organize primaries. So, you know, they basically set up a front. And it's not to say that there may be people in that NGO who think that what they're doing is really important and you know, sort of genuinely in favor of democracy. But the fact of the matter is that it's a group that is funded completely and controlled to all intents and purposes by the IRI. So that's one of the two groups that's organizing this primary. The other group, you wouldn't figure out what their connection to the U.S. or to IRI was unless you were able somehow to get in touch with them and actually do more significant research. So that, on the one hand, there's a certain amount that you can learn by just doing web searches, by looking at, by sort of familiarizing yourself with the main players in the sort of democracy promotion game, like IRI and NDI and NED and USAID and all these sort of acronyms, and sort of checking, you know, cross-referencing certain groups that you might be interested in and just seeing if they're receiving funding from these groups. And, you know, it's very difficult because it's not to say that every single group that receives funding from USAID is, you know, inherently just a sort of pawn of U.S. empire. It's not that simple. But it should certainly make you a little bit more sort of skeptical maybe about to what degree they are working in the interests of U.S. empire and to what degree they're really reflecting interests of popular sectors in the country. I mean, so that's one way of doing it, which is just to kind of do that research. But it's, you know, it's very time-consuming, and it really means that you have to focus on, you have to decide you're interested in a specific NGO and want to sort of vet them. And there's, you may not turn anything up by doing that kind of preliminary research, and it would only be if you were in the country and able to get them on the spot in an interview, you know, with a tape recorder there and say, you know, where do you get your funding? That sometimes works because, you know, as I said, this is an overt strategy, and it's not illegal. You know, there's nothing illegal about groups receiving money from the U.S. government. It certainly kind of can taint them politically, but because it's not illegal, and because it's the whole point of the strategy is that because it's overt, it can exist in the open. It makes it, you know, it opens so many doors that sort of covert kind of old school CIA strategies wouldn't have open to them. You know, but the downside is that, you know, the IRI kind of, if you get it on the spot, has to admit that they're funding certain groups. You can do Freedom of Information Act requests. You know, there's ways of turning this information up. But for the most part, it's really labor intensive. And in some cases, you actually have to be able to talk to people directly, whether by phone or being in the country. One test, I suppose, is to sort of have some kind of frame of reference for a given context. I mean, you know, if you're talking about Nicaragua again, you know, if you have any kind of access to, you know, someone whose politics you really trust, who is writing about the country, you can sort of use them as a frame of reference. Or if you know someone in the country, generally speaking, in third world countries, the groups that are doing, that are most plugged into popular consciousness and who are doing the most to defend and sort of champion that popular consciousness, they're not really NGOs. They're social movements. They're, you know, small groups of people. They're barrio associations. They're, you know, community groups. And they don't have the profile that NGOs have. They don't have the sort of technical expertise. They don't have the people with English language writing skills so that they can apply for grants. They don't have necessarily the legal status to receive them. And that's, you know, they don't necessarily have the time to be worrying about that because they're generally, you know, rooted in a given community and plugged into very specific struggles opposing the privatization of water, you know, promoting the development of education or healthcare initiatives in their community. It's very difficult, and it's not so simple as, you know, if they're an NGO, they're inherently bad, or, you know, they're a social movement, they're inherently good. But in some ways, that's an important sort of a frame of reference that can be relevant in the third world context, because so few genuine grassroots movements have any access to the kind of NGO status. And so there are some NGOs that work with groups like that, but they're few and far between. But definitely, it's one of the most difficult elements of this work, I suppose, in terms of researching the strategy, would be figuring out who, what the sort of interests are behind a given group. The last thing that I would say about that is that you can maybe more easily, from, you know, from far away, determine what interests a given group might be representing, you know, by really looking in some detail at what they're doing. If you were to just sort of read the names of, you know, projects that they're working on or something like that, you might think that an NGO like the Research Triangle Institute, for example, which is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is, you know, currently working in Iraq, in El Salvador, in Haiti, a variety of different countries, has done work in South Africa. If you just looked at the names of projects that they're working on, you might think that this is a fantastic group. They're promoting decentralization. They're promoting participatory budgets. I mean, it sounds like exactly the kind of thing that people in the global social justice movement are supporting, people at the World Social Forum, people in social movements all over the world are working for in their own communities. When you start looking in a little bit more detail at what the effect of those projects are, you start to realize that these groups, like, for example, the Research Triangle Institute and a whole slew of other groups, you know, our Research Triangle Institute is an NGO, technically. It's basically a research group set up by the University of North Carolina, but for all intents and purposes, operates like a private company. And the way that they implement or kind of, you know, coach the implementation of decentralization, for example, in a variety of different countries, is to convince governments, you know, centralized governments to pass legislation to permit sort of the decentralization of responsibility to local governments. And then they sort of sit back and wait for local governments to choke because resources haven't been decentralized along with responsibility. And then they step in and they offer their sort of technical expertise and they sort of organize things and they say, well, you know, in the healthcare sector, you don't have enough money because now you have all these added responsibilities. You're going to have to implement user fees. You know, in water, you know, provision of water or electricity, you know, it's a state-run company. It's a, you know, now it's a local state-run company. And you can't handle the responsibility because you don't have the resources, so you're going to have to start implementing user fees. And basically what they end up doing is promoting privatization. They've learned not to use that term anymore because it's now a dirty word. So they end up promoting public-private partnerships, which sounds really wonderful and happy, and everyone gets along, you know, partnership, right? But effectively, it's privatization without the sort of name recognition that, you know, privatization has sort of developed over the past few years.
And really, so much of understanding this idea of democracy promotion is understanding the doublespeak that's going on. I'd like to hear a little bit of your reflection on where you see Canada's position in this strategy for sort of neoliberal expansion and control over the global south through democracy promotion. Where does Canada fit into this?
You know, that's a really important question, and it's something that our group is focused on, but in some ways we are less sort of far along in sort of figuring that out, mainly because in terms of studying the U.S. role, we can fall back on existing studies, and, you know, the sort of critical analysis of democracy promotion is not a large field. There are very few people who are sort of actively working on this research. Those that are working on it almost universally focus on the U.S. So there's a lot less work done already existing sort of on what Canada's role is. But, you know, people in our group, like Anthony Fenton, for example, is a good example of someone who's really focused on Canada and Canada's role in Haiti. You know, we're starting to do that research and starting to figure that out. And there's certain patterns that are kind of emerging and certain things that you can pick up once you start kind of thinking critically about this that you can just sort of pick up from the mainstream media. And, you know, this is something really interesting that Phil Agee sort of pointed out to me in the interview that I did with him, where he said he wrote his book. He left the CIA in 1967, and then in, I think it was 72 or 73, he published a sort of tell-all book all about the operations that he was involved in and what the CIA does. And when he published that book, the CIA was convinced that he had kept files throughout the 10 years or 12 years that he was in the CIA, and that he had used them to write the book. And in fact, he never kept any files. And all he did was he basically spent years combing through newspaper archives from the cities where he was stationed. And then he would read something that to the normal person wouldn't make any sense, wouldn't sort of set off any alarm bells whatsoever. But he would recognize that that was an operation that they had organized. And, you know, and he would sort of see through the doublespeak or see through the just sort of apparently benign news story and see the operation underneath. And that's how he recreated all of the operations that he describes in his book. And that's sort of, you know, the strategy that we're employing in some ways in this group, which is to, once you kind of start to understand how democracy promotion works, you can read mainstream media, you can read reports issued by government institutions or foreign policy think tanks, and maybe see through them to a certain degree and start to understand a little bit of, you know, what they're really doing. Canada, it seems, specifically with Haiti, has really started thinking about how to create a niche for itself in the global democracy promotion sort of strategy, especially with the last two governments that we've had. I mean, the present one and the Martin government. You have governments that are very close to Washington that are very seriously trying to appease Washington and trying to kind of get back in the game and, you know, sort of keep close to, U.S. foreign policy. So you have the kind of cooperation that emerged in the overthrow of the elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti in 2004, where Canada cooperated very closely with the U.S. and with France in the coup in the first place, and then in the sort of support for the, you know, sort of U.S.-appointed interim government that lasted 2 years. And then another example is obviously Canada's role in Afghanistan. What's happening is that, for whatever reason, the sort of global context has changed since the 90s in such a way that peacekeeping isn't quite accurate anymore in terms of describing Canada's role in either of its two major foreign engagements present, which would be Afghanistan and Haiti. And democracy promotion sort of fits the bill a little bit better. You have a lot of activity in Canadian foreign policy think tanks, you know, foreign affairs organized conferences, including, you know, the NED recently organized a conference that was held in Ottawa in April. So you have a lot of activity in these kinds of circles, elite sort of foreign policy circles in Canada, where people are sort of saying, you know, we need to expand Canada's role in terms of democracy promotion. We need to sort of redefine our role and foreign policy role and, you know, sort of find this niche for ourselves. Really, I think what Canada is looking to do is sort of figure out what the most efficient sort of division of labor is. You know, if the U.S. is going to play certain roles and Europe is maybe going to have a certain role, you know, what role will be left for Canada? One of the ways in which I think that division of labor is being sort of divvied up is by region, where you have Europe obviously playing a very prominent role in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, in democracy promotion in those areas, in democracy promotion in Central Asia, and to a certain extent, although this is really a very young sort of strategy in Africa. You know, so you have Canada starting to assert itself to a certain extent in mainly in the Caribbean, partly because it has that sort of natural advantage of having a French-speaking foreign policy establishment that puts us at a sort of advantage to the U.S. and some Caribbean countries. And to a certain extent, I think that also incorporates Central America, although obviously not for the language reasons. And you see Canada sort of starting to, you know, trying to organize a parallel kind of CAFTA from, you know, Central American countries to Canada, and something that would incorporate the Caribbean. This is sort of, you know, in a way, almost Canada's backyard in a certain respect. I mean, in the eyes of this sort of foreign policy elite in Canada, this is a natural sort of place to expand economically and politically. It's almost that you can see it as almost an extension of NAFTA in some respects, you know, Canada really being one of, you know, really supporting the U.S. at every step of the way towards the free trade area of the Americas. On the one hand, I would say this strategy hasn't quite been defined clearly enough by Canada. Canada isn't quite sure exactly what the role that it's going to play is yet, and it's sort of experimenting with a bunch of different things. And, you know, there's some indication from some of the work that they've been doing that Canada is really thinking about Haiti as a laboratory for Canadian foreign policy. And they're using this whole experience of the coup and then the post-kind of coup situation and now the post-election situation, now that they've sort of failed at promoting a more friendly candidate and sort of, you know, succeeding in handing the election to a more U.S. OECD country-friendly candidate. But still, Préval, you know, is someone that they can probably work with and trying to, you know, so there's still a large Canadian presence in Haiti after, even though the election has taken place. And there's a, sort of this indication that this is perceived to be kind of a laboratory. You know, where Canada's sort of trying to define itself in terms of the strategy and trying to figure out what its role should be. And so to a certain extent, it's not clear yet, but certainly it's something that seems to be gaining adherence in the foreign policy establishment in Canada. It seems to be gaining in sort of in importance. There's, you know, in some of these circles, there's, you know, seems to be a lot of talk about establishing basically a Canadian version of the National Endowment for Democracy. And, you know, and there are already certain Canadian NGOs that work very closely with the NED and with other sort of more experienced democracy promoters. Just one example with respect to Latin America would be FOCAL, which I'm not even sure what that stands for exactly, but it's basically a foreign policy think tank with respect to Canada, you know, kind of Western Hemispheric relations. And the conference that was recently organized in Ottawa with the NED, that was FOCAL and the NED working together, organized a conference about democracy promotion. That conference was held in Ottawa in April. Another way that, you know, I would sort of anticipate Canada sort of defining its role would be, you know, within the sort of strategy of democracy promotion, there's subcategories where, you know, you have, as I mentioned before, people that focus on decentralization, people that focus on good governance, you know, people that focus on anti-corruption and transparency and accountability. You know, then there's people that focus more specifically on elections, et cetera. And it, you know, it may be that Canada sort of picks one of those subcategories to make its sort of specialty. But certainly it does appear that Canada is trying to find a niche for itself in the democracy promotion strategy, in the global democracy promotion strategy.
And for Canadians that might be surprised or might feel, I know there's been a number of people that have been quite disturbed by the turn toward more militaristic behavior by Canadians overseas, particularly in Afghanistan, but also as we've learned more about what Canada's role has been in Haiti, particularly through some of the training of the Haitian National Police and the role that the RCMP has played, for instance. You wrote a really interesting article, I think, that sort of reflects on some of the deep roots of these ideas behind democracy promotion, some of its deep roots in the history of capitalism, the history of colonialism, and you were reflecting on that currently in terms of Canada's experience with the First Peoples that are in Canada and some of the current conflicts that we're seeing take place and be played out in the Six Nations, some of the concerns over threats to Tiyanidaga. And I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit about how democracy has been used as a euphemism for domestic colonialism for a long time, even in Canada, that has this maybe a nicer appearance sometimes than the States does.
Yeah, I think one of the important things for Canadians to understand, one of the sort of instructive things about democracy promotion in general, is to look at the basis upon which, you know, Canada would be promoting democracy in the first place. I mean, certainly there's, I think, a very strong argument to be made that Canada has a very, certainly a somewhat problematic democracy, and that this may sort of jeopardize in some ways its sort of legitimacy in promoting democracy abroad. I mean, the argument that I make in the article that you're talking about is that Canada actually got into the democracy promoting business, in a sense, you know, in the 19th century when, in 1899, the RCMP invaded the Mohawk Reserve at Akwesasne and imposed the band council system, which was something that was part of the Indian Act, which was passed in, 1876 or something like that. This whole idea of the band council system was that native reserves had to have an electoral, you know, democratic structure. And this, you know, was seen as a sort of benevolent move by the Canadian government to sort of teach these somewhat backward, you know, primitive tribes, you know, how to civilize them in terms of teaching them democracy and bringing democracy to them. And, you know, there's a lot of parallels there in terms of the strategy more broadly now with the Third World. In Akwesasne in 1899, the RCMP, you know, invaded the reserve, arrested all of the chiefs, picked 15 sort of friendly Indians and told them to appoint each other, and that was the elected council. And so, you know, a contemporary chief of Akwesasne, Chief Mitchell, you know, refers to this as the sort of Canadian Mohawks induction into Canadian democratic system. This is the kind of democracy in a way that's been promoted domestically in Canada with the kind of Canadian internal kind of domestic colonial context where you have the white settlers on the indigenous population, and this imposition of a sort of Western political structure with no regard whatsoever to traditional power structures, traditional forms of communal organization, collective ownership, and collective sort of organization, is exactly the same kind of sort of imperial power relations that are being exercised today, but you know, for the most part between, you know, so-called First World countries and so-called Third World countries. But so, you know, the interesting thing, what I was sort of trying to explore a little bit was Canada's domestic history with this between the Canadian government and different Indigenous nations, and to what extent that is relevant today, you know, given that Canada wants to play this sort of more prominent role promoting democracy abroad. You know, some of the interesting things that Ronald Wright points out in his book, Stolen Continents, is that the Six Nations Confederacy was the first democracy in the Western Hemisphere, and yet the Canadian government is trying to teach the Six Nations, trying to bring democracy to them, you know, hundreds of years after they've invented it for this hemisphere, by imposing this sort of band council structure, which was really, in many ways, a method of controlling or having some influence over, you know, Indigenous power structures by making the band council the channel through which all federal funding would go to a given reserve or a given nation. You know, so I think there's some important parallels, and certainly my experience is sort of thinking about this in terms of reading some books like, you know, Ronald Wright's book that I mentioned, and thinking about contemporary examples, you know, Oka, Ipperwash, the current standoff at Six Nations, and a general feeling of, you know, continued sort of difficult relations between different indigenous nations and the Canadian government is, in a sense, regardless of what your position on what Canada's foreign policy, you know, promoting democracy might be, to what extent do we even really have a business, you know, presuming to be, to have sort of such a good handle on democracy that we can begin exporting it when there seem to be such fundamental flaws with it inside Canada in the first place?
And I understand from your article that in this in the current conflict on Six Nations territory, that there is that the Band Council has actually elected to make the traditional council the body with whom the federal and provincial governments need to negotiate. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting example, because on the one hand, actually, somebody said to me, well, you know, look, the Canadian government's learning something. You know, they're not so bad as they were before. They're now negotiating with the traditional Longhouse chiefs. the fact of the matter is that they don't have a choice. They, I'm sure, would prefer to negotiate with the Band Council. I mean, that's traditionally been the position of the Canadian government in any of these kinds of situations where they refuse to deal with anyone but the Band Council. But in this case, the Band Council has actually elected to, as you said, elected to divest their authority to negotiate land claims to the traditional Longhouse chiefs, which I don't think was sort of a random kind of benevolent sort of decision on the part of the Band Council. I think it was a recognition on their part that these were the authorities that had the legitimacy with the population. One of the things that a variety of different historians of Canadian Indigenous nations have sort of come across is an incredibly low participation rate in the election of band councils in many different reserves in many nations, where for most people they still think of they still consider the traditional chiefs to be their kind of leaders, and the band councils are elected by a very, very small percentage of the population. I don't know exactly what the statistics are for Six Nations. I have no idea, and it may be that the band council also has tremendous legitimacy, but certainly it was indicative, and it was an important move on their part to sort of elect to appoint to give this power to negotiate the land claims with the federal government to the traditional Longhouse chiefs.
And just finally, just to wrap up right now, people can find the articles and some of the research that's being done by In the Name of Democracy, by this activist research collective at inthenameofdemocracy.org. What are some of the next steps for this project?
One of the things that we're, you know, basically working on right now is trying to do as much research as we can and sort of cover as much, as many countries as possible that are in, you know, currently having presidential elections in Latin America this year, as well as a number of other countries. You know, as I said, there's some people working on the Balkans and on the Middle East. We're just going to try and, on the one hand, do as much in-depth research as possible, and on the other hand, also write, you know, articles for sort of more kind of popular consumption. I mean, as much as possible, if possible, have some kind of, try to get some information into the mainstream media. Also try to, to share our research with people working in other mediums, specifically radio, because it has such a high appeal in terms of almost, you know, sort of being more of a more democratized medium than writing. To that end, we have, you know, relationships with with certain community radio programs in New York and in Colombia, and we're hoping to sort of develop some with other community radio stations in other countries. But basically, we're doing this research, trying to do as much in-depth research as possible, and then in early 2007, we're going to put together a report which will just bring all of the research that we've done together, put in one place, with sort of lengthy, you know, kind of an in-depth, you know, introduction to the whole theme, a discussion of how it's been applied in different regions, why we're focusing on Latin America, et cetera, some discussion of our methodology and research skills that we've been able to put to good use, and then just to have this report as a kind of example of the kind of work that we think needs to be done, and as a way of sort of hoping to attract more people, more researchers, more activists to our group to work with us. As in terms of like a mid to long term plan, we really hope to have more direct connections to specific social movements, you know, in Latin America and all over the world. We've found that the people that are currently in the group have a specific, all are active in different kind of groups and causes, but also all have certain research capacities, and that's sort of what one of the sort of most effective things that we can do right now is to start educating North American population about this whole idea that democracy promotion isn't necessarily a good thing. Because the funny experience that we had in sort of initially thinking that, you know, we'd also be able to be providing some of this material to social movements in, you know, Latin American countries, for example, is I was down in Nicaragua in the fall and talking to people and saying, you know, IRI is here and they're doing this, and, you know, and people there, it's an open secret. Like, they know what democracy promotion means when the U.S. says that's what they're doing. They know what U.S. foreign policy means in their country. And it's sort of irrelevant whether or not they know that any given specific NGO is funded by the U.S. government or, you know, et cetera. They understand how this stuff works. They understand, you know, generally what's going on. In some ways, you know, there's little that they can do about it. Or in some ways, what they can do is they're sort of focusing on sort of more local struggles, you know, things like fighting the privatization of water is really important. And it really reinforced to us the sort of importance of this is a strategy, or sort of our work is something that needs to be directed very clearly at a North American audience. Not to say that we don't also want to share that information with people in the rest of the world, and especially in Latin America. We have the webpage has a Spanish page, and we post, you know, we translate material and we post material just in Spanish, etc. But certainly, one of the most important elements of our work is to kind of start trying to raise awareness about the destructive nature of this strategy, what it really is doing, and what the impact of it really is in Latin America, and how much resistance to the strategy there is in Latin America, and trying to raise awareness of that amongst sort of a North American audience, because at root, you know, fundamentally, we're the people who are supporting this strategy, whether it's, I mean, even if it's passively, just by not kind of coming out against it. You know, it's our tax dollars that are going to, you know, that are going to end up funding a new Canadian, you know, sort of version of the NED, or in the U.S., it's, you know, U.S. tax dollars that are funding that. And it's our, you know, elected officials that are championing this strategy that are, you know, are funding the Canadian military in Afghanistan, for example. So, you know, sort of more long-term goal, that's our sort of raison d'etre.